uyakwazi ukuthumela ama-email na.
We translate for those who can't understand. We write for those who can't hear. We describe for those who can't see. SubT, subtitles and accessibility for film, television and theater. SubT.com.
Fred Film Radio. I'm Matt McCucci from the 64th Berlin International Film Festival.
Io sono Valentina Pompili al Tokyo International Film Festival.
Soy Antonio Becker y estoy aquí con
el internationalen Filmfestspiel in Berlin. Mein Name ist Beatrice Beden.
Hallo, willkommen für Fred Film Radio.
Fred, the festival experience in 23 languages.
Cinephile, you're listening to the Big Fred Tuesday, Fred Film Radio's weekly show on all things cinema with a particular focus on independent filmmaking and the international film festival scene. This show is hosted and produced by yours truly, Matt McCucci, and features conversations with filmmakers and prominent figures of the international film industry. We'll be doing a bit of traveling as we first visit Lithuania to talk with the CEO of the Vilnius International Film Festival, Algirdas Ramaška, to talk about this year's edition of one of the most important film festivals in the region. We will also be heading to Canada to talk with Matthew Rankin for an extensive chat with him about his feature directorial debut, The 20th Century. The film has been around since 2019, but was also part of this year's Vilnius Film Festival lineup, and I absolutely loved it. Hopefully our interview will make you want to check it out as well. Last but not least, we will be moving to The Hague in the Netherlands, home of the Movies That Matter Festival, which is a human rights film festival based in the city that is home to the UN's International Court of Justice. We'll be talking about it with the Movies That Matter artistic director, Margita Koning. All throughout the show, we will be revisiting gems from our archive. We will also be sharing new additions to the world-famous segments, Dictionary of Film and Popcorn Classics. If you like movies and get a kick out of exploring the film world, you have come to the right place. Welcome aboard the Big Fred ship. Fire up an Audiotini, sit back, relax, and listen to the audio waves as they fly through the air.
Fred.
Joining us at this time is Algirdas Ramaška, CEO at Vilnius Film Festival and Kino Pasavaris. We will be talking about this year's edition of the Vilnius International Film Festival in Lithuania, the 26th in its history, as well as an online offering. The fest also took place in a number of top-rate hotels throughout the Lithuanian capital in response to the coronavirus pandemic. We'll find out more about it momentarily. Algirdas, welcome to the show.
Hey.
So this is great because we're going to be talking about the Vilnius International Film Festival. Forgetting for the moment the madness of the current pandemic times, I wanted to start off by just asking you, what in your opinion makes Vilnius such a great venue for a major international film festival?
Well, the first place, I would say that I think the creativity and the passion of the team, how and why we are doing things, and how crazy we are for making the audience for creating for audience an unforgettable experience, and especially of all of the pandemic situation was also a very big challenge for us, and we were desperately trying to find those physical experiences so the people will not forget or would remember on why we are good at it and what is the best in Vilnius Film Festival. So this is why the last year we managed to make this aero cinema in the airport drive-in cinema. This year we were working with the hotels, and we did this project, Holidays with the Film Festival, so the people could escape. So I think these kind of things, and in the future, you're going to see it more. Much more of that.
All right. So, while we're talking about it, this initiative with the hotels is pretty interesting. Can you tell us a bit more about it?
Yeah. So this is what we were trying to find, the ways how to give the audience a little bit of relaxation. I don't know, a little bit of this escape plan from their pandemic reality, where we are all of us stuck. And also we wanted always, and we thought that the festival can be a very good tool and an option to help other industries like tourism sector. And we wanted to prove it to our municipality, for example. So this project was, I think, and this idea was the match made in heaven, that we can have a physical experience for our audience. The audience can escape from their pandemic reality and enjoy the relaxness and relax in the hotels and enjoy the restaurants, restaurant services. Even the restaurants are closed, and they had an opportunity to see all the film festival, Vilnius Film Festival films unlimited while they are staying at a hotel. So this was, and I think, and I know it was thousands of people who came and visited, and all of the, almost all of the nights in the hotels was sold out. And the hotels were extremely happy because during the pandemic, there's no tourists coming. So they were working like it was the heaviest tourism season. So I think it was like a very, very, very good project for all of us.
It was a very successful experiment.
Yes.
And I must say that it's one of the most interesting ways in which a festival has responded to the pandemic times. So obviously these have been troubling times. Last year, as you mentioned, the festival, the Vilnius Film Festival, was one of the first to be impacted by the coronavirus pandemic. But it responded in very creative ways. And this is just another way in which you guys show that you're pioneering reacting to these things. But I'm just wondering, were you at any point expecting to be able to hold a physical edition of the festival since last year's edition?
Yes, we were getting ready for the physical edition, and I think for any of the festival organizers, even to think about virtual edition, it hurts already because it's not the same, and it's not the, I don't know, you don't see the audience, you don't see their emotions, you don't have the connection with them. And this is not the same, and we just can't wait to go for like to normal edition of the festival. And this year we were like second time in a row we were virtual, and to be honest, even if it was successful, keeping in mind in what conditions we are. But I wouldn't say that we will go third time for a virtual edition because it's just killing us.
Yeah,
I just can't wait to get to this normal edition and to see the audience, the real audience, and to see their eyes and emotions, and this is the payback that all of us appreciate the most. And this is why we do it, because this is the payback for our team, is to see the audience and to see how we can transform their lives with our films.
We'll be back for more in a moment, so stay tuned.
Fred.
We're back with Algirdas Ramaška, CEO at the Vilnius Film Festival, the 26th edition of which we have just been talking about. It has just ended. And just to give a better idea of the way the festival is structured, what are its competitions and what are some of its signature strands?
So we had this year, we had 59 features and 44 shorts. Usually in the normal edition, we had like more than 100 features and also like about 50 shorts. But this year we wanted to go more deep, I don't know, to work better on a lower scale of the films, but to make sure that all of them will find their audience. Because the audience also dropped a bit during this virtual festival, comparing with the normal festival that we had. Talking about the programs, so we have a competition program that we are very proud about. It's debuting European. It's a competition of European debuts. So we have European debuting directors films, and every year we have like 10 films in competition. And this year we had a very, very strong competition, which we are very proud about. And also we have a wide selection of the films that was presented in other festivals in the different sections, which is festivals. It's like Panorama, it's Critics' Choice, it's Masters. And we have also short competition, short films competition, and shorts should be made from European directors and who still don't have the feature film made yet. So it's a lot about things that we screen at the festival. It talks about the young talents, new talents that we're trying to discover. This is all of it. It's in a one strategy, talking about the industry event, the Meeting Point Vilnius, that will start in April 14th, where we have Talent Nest, we have the pitchings of the projects that also are from debuting directors. And this goes like from industry event to the festival competition programs. And we also have the distribution company that we are distributing the first films from the directors in Lithuania, not only international ones, but also we trying to help and to promote young talents and new directors from Lithuania. And we have a lot of very successful cases for that.
This is a question that has just occurred to me as well, because in the introduction, you mentioned that you'd like for audiences to have a good experience at the festival always when they attend. Do you feel that in the 26 years of the festival, there has also been a project of audience development in Vilnius, but also for the entire country?
It was huge. I remember how we started. When I joined the festival maybe 16, 18 years ago. So, and how we developed the audience through all of these years. And since we had last, like in a normal festival, 2019, we had 126,000 admissions. And we expanded our activities and screenings of these films, not only in Vilnius city, but in other cities, since the country is very small in general. It's just 3 million people in general. So we were screening films in different cities, and our goal was to make it available to audiences where they, you know, wherever they are, so everyone in the country could just literally see the films that we screen, even because we promote them national wide, and it was huge development of the audience, but for the future, I believe, and also because of the pandemic, the strategy will change a bit, and probably we will. We will go not for the quantity to have even more audience, but we will go to the quality of the experience and what we can offer for the audience and what we can offer for the tourists who will come to Vilnius Film Festival. What kind of exceptional experience we can offer and what kind of creative experience we can offer. For example, watching a film, a classical film, in the opera, in a very beautiful atmosphere and with a live orchestra, or maybe to see, I don't know, a film Annette by Leo Carax, and later on to go and see the live performance of Sparks. So something... talking about this, but also working with other cultural, you know, like dancing performances with other artists, what we can create and perform to expand the experience of watching film. Basically, this is what we are thinking about.
To return to this year's edition, Algirdas, would you be able to tell us about some of the films that won this year?
Of course. So the great film that won the two awards in the competition for the best actress and for the best film in the debuting competition, which was very, very, very nice. And it's by Itonia Sommer Gutenesman, a film great. That was, and the Birgit Larsen, who won the Best Actress Award. So this is one of the biggest winner. Also, we were very proud that the Lithuanian title that was premiered in our festival won the Fibrisi Award. It's People We Know Are Confused by Tomas Mulkis. And this is something that made us proud as Lithuanians. And also, it was one of the audience favorite award. It's an audience award went to Jasmilas Banič, Oscar-nominated Kua Vadis Aida, which just I think was one of the biggest hits by the, like, watched by the audience. And also, I can mention just a few of the films that was, became the hit,
sure,
in our festival. So it was, The Big Hit, the French, comedy film. And I would say that, Rado Jude film.
But is it Bad Luck Banging and, Loony Porn?
Yes.
The improbably titled Bad Luck Banging and Loony Porn, I would add.
Because I was mentioning this name so many times in Lithuanian just now. Literally, I forgot the English translation. But this is the Golden Bear winner. And it was fun to have this year in the festival two Golden Bears winners, because we opened the festival with There Is No Evil of Mohamed Rasoulouf. Film and we also had another judo film. So this year we had like two Golden Bears in the festival program.
Excellent. All right, Algirdas, I think we gave an interesting portrait of what the Vilnius International Film Festival was this year, and I thank you very much for joining us and talking with us about it. Again, congratulations.
Thank you. Red
Film Radio. As mentioned, Grit by Norwegian director Itonia Sommer Guttormsen was awarded Best Film in the European debut competition of the 26th Vilnius International Film Festival. We actually talked with her on an earlier episode of the Big Fred Tuesday, and here is a clip of that interview. Would you maybe say a few words to be able to say a few words to sort of introduce the story of Grit?
Yes. Well, Grit is about a woman in her late 30s who has been... She's very driven by ideas and ideals, and she wants to live a life where she is in the service of art. She wants to change the world through art. And she has been abroad her whole adult life and living from hand to mouth, all the way from Hollywood to Aalborg, a small place in Denmark, experimental theater groups, etc. And now she's back in Oslo, and she wants to make this huge collective radical ritual performance that she wants to help the population of Oslo over in a new era, basically. So that's the starting point of the film.
Even just thinking back to the film, it's difficult to know exactly where I want to start off because there's so much that I'd like to ask you. But I'm curious about this concept of the white inflammation that looms over the film throughout its duration, but also both as an integral part of the narrative, but also I felt the general vibes of the trials and tribulations of the character of Grit as we see it. But where does it originate? And, you know, what is this concept, the white inflammation?
Yeah, that's the name of her art project, which is trying to fund and have people join. And it comes from, because she's been like very into, in different underground like movements. And so she knows quite a few, of course, she has some ideals. And Antonin Artaud is one of those, the theater, radical theater creator. And he talks about in his book Le Théâtre est son double, he talks about this white plague or the color of white, which is kind of a poison that in Asia, they see whiteness as this poison in a way. And she has probably read that somewhere early on, but still she has this vision about that the Scandinavian spirit, the capitalistic society, like it's all this white inflammation. And especially because she's Norwegian and born here, etc., but she's kind of an alien and kind of a refugee herself. She doesn't have a place to live and she's not really integrated. So I feel that she's kind of experiencing this downside of the Scandinavian society because she doesn't, the safety system is too rigid for her, and then she doesn't have this other like good economy, or so she's quite homeless in every sense. So this becomes a kind of an image of this society where you're not able to enter in a way.
Do you think that being an artist generally entails living outside of what is usually seen as the social norm? Perhaps not in exactly in the way that Grit does in this film, but to some degree.
To some degree and to some, I guess. But in Norway, we have this very like well-developed support system for the arts. And we're so lucky compared to many others. But then again, we are not trained to go. It's like that's the only way. So that it's very hard if you're not measuring into those criteria, because that, of course, is very hierarchical. And you have to have this and this education, or it's all judged by a jury, and everyone knows each other. So if you're coming from abroad with a bit of a suspicious background, and you haven't been to these and these schools, or which is the case of Grit, then you are easily creating some kind of suspiciousness on people around you. And but it's strange though, because the way that Grit moves and the experiences she has are quite valuable, because she's getting into all these kinds of situation and encounter all kind of people, which does make fuel for art or material for art. And her whole experience as a person and as a human being is quite on the edge of existence. Like so she has some quite interesting and passionate and necessary like messages to come across, if you know what I mean. So it's a good fuel for an artist, I think, but it's also totally on the verge of what is possible to live and to make something happen, at least in Norway.
Yeah. Are there any autobiographical elements to be read in the movie? Because you, of course, also wrote the screenplay for the film.
Yes, I'm very playful about the way I make films, but of course, before being able to get this, I was struggling for I think 11 years to fund this film and make it happen, and had my very strange way to be able to do my first feature, where I did get a lot of experiences, and of course being very poor at times, and I think it's, you know, this. If you have a feeling, if you're driven by a goal and a want and a vision and something you want to materialize and make and have this strong need to express, I think it's when you're not expressing, when you're far from that, you're basically going around in shame. And this is a kind of a very strange feeling, because others doesn't have to necessarily look at you that way. But for you, it's kind of a humiliation. Every day, not being able to do what you feel you should do. And this is a core feeling I definitely have felt, which is maybe the seed for this character, this desperation almost.
To listen to the full interview, check out fred.fm/UK.
Fred Film Radio.
Joining us at this time on the Big Fred Tuesday is director Matthew Rankin, whose awesome film The 20th Century was part of this year's program of the Vilnius International Film Festival in Lithuania. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Hi, Matt. Nice to be with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. You know, first off, I gotta say, I absolutely loved the 20th century, the film, and also the century, I guess. But it's one of those films that I really hope to catch on the big screen soon, because, you know, due to the times that we're living in, had to experience it in the small screen. But it was just awesome. So usually what I do is I start off the interviews by actually saying a few words of introduction to the film. But somehow, when I was kind of thinking about what I should say for this one, I kind of found it difficult to do so. So I was wondering, would you be able to maybe, just for our listeners who are not familiar with it yet, just introduce it a little bit?
Sure. It's what I would describe as a historical fantasia, and it's based on the diary kept by William Lyon Mackenzie King, who was the Prime Minister of Canada for almost 22 years, between the 1920s and 1940s. And he kept a diary his entire life. He was a compulsive diarist, a lifelong bachelor, and he had all sorts of very enchanting pathologies and obsessions. And I read his diary as a young man that he kept during his 20s, and the film is sort of based on his punctured romances and Victorian obsessions and mother worship and his early political vocation. And all of those sort of real events from his life and real characters of his life are fed through a kind of oniric prism, is the way I would describe it. It's kind of, I would describe it as a nightmare that he might have had in 1899 rather than a straight up biopic. And, so, yeah, but it's got elements of romantic comedy. It's got elements of, you know, war epic. It's got elements of political intrigue and, you know, Victorian self-help manual.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot in it, and hopefully we'll be getting to some of that throughout the course of this interview, because there's so much that I want to ask you. But just to start off, you know, pardon my ignorance, I'm pretty ignorant on the on this topic, but what is people's opinion of William Lyon Mackenzie King in contemporary Canada? I mean, is he taught in school? Would he be considered one of the important historical figures of Canada?
He certainly is. He's, you know, he's largely, I don't think he enjoys much, much of a place in kind of popular imagination. He's thought of as a very boring politician in a lot of ways. People do know about his private life a little bit. When I sort of began getting interested in him, I only knew a few things about him. I knew that he was, I knew he was obsessed with his mother and that he had, a very obsessive relationship with his dogs. He was a lifelong bachelor, but he had these three dogs, and he each named them the same name, and he was he had a state funeral for them when they died, and so he was he had these bizarre obsessions, and he was obsessed with ectoplasm. He was a spiritualist, so he would attend seances and attempt to communicate with great leaders of the British past. Gladstone was a very important influence on him. So he would try to communicate with Gladstone's ectoplasm through these ghostly seances and, you know, try to, you know, receive advice. And anyway, so I knew a little bit about this, and I all of this just enchanted me. And then when I started to read his diary, I started to get a little bit deeper into it. But, you know, that, beyond this, he's not, he's not a character that's particularly celebrated in Canada. He's on the $50 bill, and there's a few parks named after him and stuff like that, but he doesn't exert great power over the Canadian imagination, except to the degree that he was an extremely successful politician. He was prime minister for 22 years, and he developed this kind of, method of, brokerage politics based on absolute compromise and ambiguity. He's a very accomplished centrist, and he kind of developed the recipe for political longevity that most Canadian politicians have attempted to emulate, since his time, because he still remains the longest serving, prime minister, I think, in the British parliamentary history.
Oh, right.
So he exerts some influence politically, and his political vocation is devoted to this idea of compromise. He's a very historic moderate politician. And he walked this very, very fine line between the, you know, apocalypse and utopia of his era. And that is sort of, that is something that we can trace, certainly into contemporary Canadian politics. And I think centrism, broadly speaking, is something that can be traced to Mackenzie King in a lot of ways.
I see. Yeah, he sounds like a fascinating person, especially because of those journals that you talked about. But aside from those diaries and those journals, do you find that this historical period is particularly fascinates and inspires you?
Yeah, it does. I really love the early 20th century. I find to be very, very interesting because it was... you know, the turn of that century was an extremely hopeful time. It was a time in which vast populations had a very strong conviction that human beings, in fact, had the power to overcome all of their problems, that technology was going to help us, that we were going to figure this all out, that every problem we had the power to resolve it and build a braver, fairer, new, more harmonious, more loving world. And of course, as the century went on, a lot of these ideas, transformed into nightmares or were revealed to be nightmares or just collapsed completely or were crushed. And now I feel like we began this century, and I think that this has only advanced, you know, in the 21 years that has passed. I feel like there's a sense of hopelessness that has taken over. You know, and it's exactly the opposite of the way the previous century, began. We now look to the future as, you know, with a certain amount of dread, whereas, you know, 120 years ago, they looked to the future with absolute conviction. So there's a measurement of something there. And, so I was interested in getting back into the kind of like, you know, early utopian neurons of the turn of that century.
We'll be back for more on the 20th century in a moment.
Fred.
Speaking with Matthew Rankin about his film, The 20th Century, and we had started to talk about some of the ways in which the turn of the 20th century fascinates you, Matthew. And I have to say, I'm also fascinated with it because some of the things that you talked about, and even looking towards the future with that sense of hope and belief that all our problems would be solved and that we'd have it all figured out, that all fascinates me. But it was also a time of great ideas that were reflected in the arts and in the great avant-garde art movements of the time, like futurism and expressionism. Stylistically, I felt those turn-of-the-century art movements influenced the amazing visual character of the film too. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, I would say to a degree. It's I sort of feel like German expressionism doesn't really work except in black and white, but a lot of people do see, you know, elements of Metropolis in the movie Fritz Lang's Metropolis, and I think that's true. I think Fritz Lang is sort of, you know, this film has many parents, and Fritz Lang is certainly one that's kind of hovering over it a bit. But I think more broadly speaking, you know, I was particularly influenced by mid-century modernists. I think in particular, Karol Zeman, the Czech animator, was a big influence on me. And he made all these hybrid films, kind of colliding live action and animation. And that was a big influence on this film. Fellini as well. But I think that, yeah, it's the film has a very artificial, natural world. The world is depicted very geometrically, and it's very false. We're sort of constantly confronted by the artifice of the world we're seeing in the movie. And that was sort of part of the historical conceit. I wanted, you know, this movie is kind of about Mackenzie King and his nation-building project in Canada at the sort of earliest stage of its development as a nation-state. And I wanted the audience to be constantly confronted by the artificiality of that operation, that, you know, that there's this almost architectural idea of nation that's being artificially grafted upon the natural world. And it's all just a dream. It's all something that somebody has imagined and is imposing upon this space. And so that is sort of the, you know, that's sort of the driving force. And I it's also a historical film, but I wanted people to be constantly aware that it was fake. That, you know, like a lot of times when we make a film, broadly speaking, but especially when we make a historical film, we're trying to convince people of the credibility of what they're seeing, you know. So there's very, very intense period detail, you know, authenticity is kind of the goal. In this film, it was quite the opposite. I was trying to make it as fake as I could. And what I like about that is that people, when they watch it, they typically kind of, you know, they don't know how much of it is true and how much of it is fake. Some of it they presume must be fake, and some of it they presume must be true. But between the two, there's this bizarre interzone, and they're not really sure. And I think that that's kind of like a really interesting tension for a viewer to have when they watch a historical film. Like, I think this is why historians typically hate historical films, is because they are so convincing, and the power of cinema to imitate reality is so seductive that a lot of times we'll walk away from a historical film thinking, "Ah, well, that's what happened." Whereas the historian knows that actually it's way more complex than that, and this is just, you know, a constructed reality. And so I wanted that constructed reality to be very, very, very available to the viewer. And I like that tension of not knowing how much is fake and how much is real. Because that's true of any historical film we'll watch.
Yeah, what about a sense of timelessness? Were you also looking to achieve that?
Yeah, it's true. It's kind of a cross-section of the 20th century writ large. I was really inspired by the Terry Gilliam film Brazil. It's got elements of that in it. I think there's a title card at the beginning of Brazil where Terry Gilliam writes, "Somewhere in the 20th century." and that was sort of what I was thinking. I was kind of, you know, it's a bit of a direct influence. I wanted it to kind of feel like it could be kind of anywhere in the 20th century, broadly speaking. But it's kind of, you know, though it takes place in 1899, like the whole film basically takes place in 1899, except the very, very end. But it does kind of have a mid-century kind of look to it.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking as well of A Matter of Life and Death by the Archers, the things to come, you know.
Sure.
There's so much in it. But, you know, at the same time also, I feel like, you know, if we return to kind of this early 20th century, I mean, there was so much going on in those times and a lot of great theories, exciting theories that we may agree or disagree with about psychoanalysis too.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this film, by being dreamlike, I felt inevitably sort of has that link with what was happening, all those theories about psychoanalysis, about sexuality too. I mean, I felt like that was, they were driving, that was another driving force in the film.
Yeah. Well, that's true. I mean, it is drawn directly from his diary. And, you know, for anyone who keeps a diary listening to this, you know how melodramatic and, hysterical a document your diary is. At least my diary is like that.
Mine too. It's dangerous. They're dangerous to leave lying around too, I guess.
Well, that's right. And they're not exactly a factual chronology of events in your life. I think of them as like a parallel consciousness. You know, it's like a repository of, you know, whatever is obsessing us, whatever we can't understand. At least this is what my diary is like. It's full of all of this kind of stream of consciousness, and it's closer to a dream life than it is to a waking life, I think. Even though it's dealing with, you know, things that are going on and that kind of stuff, it's a processing, the way our dreams process what's going on in our waking lives, right? So I wanted it to be kind of close to that. I wanted it to be like a film that is inside Mackenzie King's subconscious. And of course, you know, a lot of the pressures exerted upon him are intensely Victorian. I did do a lot of research into anti-masturbation campaigns of the late 19th century. And a lot of them were in France, interestingly enough. For some reason, France was very intensely against masturbation. And all of the anti-masturbation machinery and devices and theories that that are referenced in the film, as preposterous as they seem, they all really did exist. There was like an anti-erection harness that would like sound an alarm in the middle of the night. There was, efforts at electrocution. There was something that I found in France called a cactus skin glove. And it wasn't made out of actual cactus flesh, but it was like this mitt, this leather mitt with pinpricks.
Wow.
On it. So you would wear this, or someone would force you to wear it, so that you would not masturbate. Anyway, all of these things, they all really did exist, and they do attest to like a deeply pathological relationship with desire, which, certainly is, I think, a real presence in Mackenzie King's life.
Hmm. I heard the guy who invented Kellogg's cornflakes was also into that. Very much opposed to masturbation. But the question then is, Matthew, is masturbation a threat to society?
Oh, yeah. I mean, cornflakes are a bland foodstuff, and they were intended to stop you from masturbating. They do work. They do actually work. It's anybody's guess. It's certainly masturbation is a theme that you find a lot in Canadian cinema. Canadians, I guess, sort of have something of a reputation of being passive aggressive and self pitying.
Is that true about Canadian cinema?
Yeah, I think if you were to dig into it, it's kind of it's a trope. It's a trope of national sexuality.
Wow, it sounds like a master's thesis idea for anyone listening to this.
Yeah, that'd be great.
We'll be back for the third part of our interview with Matthew Rankin in a moment.
Fred Film Radio.
Fred Film Radio.
We're back with Matthew Rankin, director of the 20th Century from this year's Vilnius International Film Festival program. I love the film, and though it's at times strange and frightening, I actually loved inhabiting the world of the film too. And I was wondering, Matthew, what was it like for the actors to be a part of this striking, dreamlike, and even bizarre world?
We did a very intense casting process, and I mean, it's a bizarre script and it's a bizarre world. And, the casting was really kind of, to see who could get inside the tone of this thing. 'Cause it's a very delicate tone. It's somewhere between the earnest and the ironic. It's melodramatic, but it's not making fun of melodrama either. It's, intensely sort of mannered, but it's still real. It's still very real. So, it came about to, kind of put together a cast that would be able to get into that tone and have fun with it. Not every actor would, get it or love it, but it was, about finding those who could. And of course, Daniel Byrne, who plays Mackenzie King, it's a real tour de force performance, and he's very much a tuning fork for the rest of the cast. He really just understood the language and the movement and, the tone just like right away. And he's a very, very gifted actor who can, even perform very, very vulnerable emotional scenes and still be very funny, which is a very unusual and bizarre talent. So he really very much became a tuning fork that, other actors could kind of like bounce off of and listen to. A lot of times we were working with sort of minimal sets, and the world is, the world of the frame is one thing, but the world of the set itself is another thing. It's even more artificial. And, so I did like a very, very intense process of storyboarding and conceptual drawings. And this was helpful for the actors too. They could see what the world would look like and, how they were interacting with it. So all of that kind of like, helped kind of establish what the thing was. And, but it kind of led everybody into a zone where they could just be in this weird, parallel universe.
Yeah. I was thinking as well how Dan Byrne kind of reminded me of Harry Langdon, in some sequences. Yeah. He has that sort of, appeal. Yeah. It's awesome. No, but I mean, that's a thing for me watching a film like that is that there's so much in it that I keep kind of like, it makes me think about other things. It's almost like a guy like me is just, I'm so excited watching it. But I wanted to ask you as well, is it true this film was also shot in 16mm and Super 8?
Yes, it is. Yeah. There's one sort of black and white propaganda sequence, and that was shot in Super 8, but wow, the rest of the film is all 60 millimeter.
Yeah, you don't see that many. I haven't come across that many films, recent films that were shot in Super 8, so especially. So, I mean, I was wondering, is it difficult to kind of work with that format these days?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there are fewer labs that can process the film, and there's less film. But, and, you know, it costs something. But, I don't know, the and I had to make some sacrifices to shoot on film. But I think fundamentally when you add everything up together and all the work you have to do in post if you shoot on digital, I really don't think that it's the difference in cost is that enormous. But it's a little bit, always going to be a little bit more expensive to shoot on film. Well, not always, but a lot of times. But I made that sacrifice because I really felt like the art direction, the special effects, the acting, and the format on which you shoot, I feel like those things always have to be very coherent with each other. And, I knew the world of this movie was going to be very fake. Like the set pieces were going to be really, really fake. And so were the special effects. They were also going to be very, very analog and very primitive. And so if I take, you know, primitive special effects with fake sets and I shoot them in glorious Spielbergian, you know, high resolution digital, I feel like that is, there's an incoherence there. There's like way too much detail in the resolution of digital. And with 60 millimeter, there's less information. And so I feel like that kind of just knits, it makes it a whole, it makes it just complete. And so for all the sacrifices involved in that decision, I feel like, you know, it's something I absolutely don't regret. For me, it would not have worked if it was shot on digital. It had to be in a sort of a less information zone. And I think always when you give less information to the viewer, you leave more space for their imagination. I met this, Icelandic doctor years ago who had this theory that, the digital signal, like, it connects directly with the linear logical elements of the brain, whereas the analog signal connects with the emotional, imaginative elements of the brain. I don't know if that's true. He might have been a total quack, but I choose to believe he's right. Certainly, I think that's true for me, personally.
Yeah, no, I think there's something to it. But yeah, I mean, it gives the film a lot of texture as well.
Yeah.
And it makes you kind of feel like you're part of that world. It felt like that to me. So I could go on and on, but I mean, we've already kind of exceeded the time. But, Matthew, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. And again, I love the film, The 20th Century. Guys, check it out. Thanks a lot, Matthew. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Matt.
Fred.
Cinephile, we have reached our weekly Dictionary of Film segment where each week I take a look at a film term, explain it, expand on it. Some of these terms you may already be familiar with, others you may not be familiar with. At the end of the day, it's just a bit of fun. But even for the experts out there, there's no reason why we shouldn't go back and brush up in our knowledge of film. For this week's segment, beginning with the letter E, I will get technical a little bit, not too much, and talk about the establishing shot, a very important shot in filmmaking. This is usually a long, wide-angle shot at the beginning of a scene or a sequence or a film that is intended to show things from a distance and to inform the audience with an overview in order to help identify and orient the locale or time for the scene and action that follows. This kind of shot is usually followed by a more detailed shot that brings characters, objects, or other figures closer. Another reason why the establishing shot is so important and why it is often seen at the start of a film is that it helps the audience understand the relationship between the characters and the setting right from the beginning. Consider, for example, the exterior shots of the Overlook Hotel in The Shining by Stanley Kubrick or of the Shawshank prison in The Shawshank Redemption. These are particularly good examples because they establish locations so important to the narrative that they are practically characters themselves. That is why it is important that they are introduced at the start. But as mentioned, establishing shots are just as important in other parts of the film's duration. Think, for example, about the shot of Willy Wonka's Incredible Chocolate Factory, allowing the viewers to see as the winners of that coveted golden ticket finally crossed its doors for the very first time. That too is an establishing shot. You could even say it's an establishing sequence. Last but not least, when the establishing shot is repeated to refresh the viewer's sense of the scene's overall geography, it is referred to as the re-establishing shot. That brings us to the end of this week's Dictionary of Film entry, where, as you can see, we explore the filmmaking technique as well as film theory, film history, and so on. But for now, stick around because we'll be back with more film chat on this very show in a moment.
Red Film Radio.
Joining us at this time is Makia de Koning, Artistic Director of Movies That Matter. We will especially be talking about the upcoming edition of Movies That Matter Festival, a festival in The Hague that, as a statement on the website reads, wants to open eyes for human rights. Makia, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I believe this is the first time Fred actually gets to speak about Movies That Matter, which is pretty exciting. We'll also be talking about Movies That Matter Festival. But I feel like, yeah, first we should introduce Movies That Matter, right? So would you be able to maybe say a few things about maybe its history and mission statement?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for hosting us. We're very happy about that, being your guest today. It started off over 13 years ago by Amnesty International, who find out, you know, film can be a starting point of a dialogue. So we should launch a small film festival. That's how it started so many years ago, with maybe 6, 7, 8 films. And then over the years, it turned out to become its own film festival. And I'm the artistic director since last year. So the first edition was cancelled a week before due to the whole COVID situation. And we are hosting now around 70, 80, 90 films. This year, a little bit less due to the COVID again and the online situation. And what it's really, it's a fiction film and documentary films with a human rights angle. And so what is, I think, unique about our festival, that every and each film will have an in-depth conversation after the film, a Q&A, which is really, really high. And due to that fact, we're also based in The Hague, which is obviously where the ICC is based, the International Court, our government. So we get a lot of politicians on our festival. And where we are proud of that, quite often films, due to shown at our festival, getting people in the festival talking about it, it really sometimes can change some of the politics nationally and internationally, which is obviously one of, we think, the best things you could happen as a film festival.
Right. This is very much a festival driven by the belief that films can be a way to get conversation started.
Yes. Yes.
All right. So just to understand the festival and just the structure a bit better, we talked about it taking place in The Hague. This year might be a little different. We'll get into that later. But generally speaking, what does it look like? What does its program look like? Are there any dedicated competitions?
Oh, absolutely. We have three main competitions. One is called the Activist Competition. It's 8 documentaries where the protagonist of the film is an activist. To give you an example, for this year, we have Nashrin, who is a women activist and a lawyer in Tehran. She's now actually in the prison due to her work. And so we have loads of activist films. Then we have, it's called Camera Justitia. That's fiction and documentary. We have films where a court case in whatever way is within, included in the content of the film. Quo Vadis, which is now an Oscar nominee, for instance, is this year in that competition, to give you an idea. And then a very new film, President, of about the what's going, the elections in Zimbabwe, is also a film which will be premiered in our festival. And then we have the Dutch Movies Matter competition. These are all films, also fiction and documentary, made by Dutch filmmakers. And this year we have, for the first time, a grand jury documentary and a grand jury fiction. We choose 8 documentaries and 8 fiction films, and the best wins the prize. So where it all comes together, really strong content, good storytelling, and beautiful cinematography.
Right. And again, a mix of documentaries and feature films. Yeah. And I take it from all 4 corners of the globe, too.
Absolutely. We get films from This year, China was difficult due to the fact that it's online. There was a bit of censorship going on, but we honestly get films from all corners of the world. Absolutely. South America, Africa, the United States, Europe, of course. All corners. Absolutely. It's a very international festival.
The festival returns this year, and as you mentioned, it will be online.
Yeah.
So when was this decision taken, and what are some of the challenges that you faced in planning this year's edition?
Well, it was hard because we postponed our festival for a month in order to hope that we could do things offline and that we could make a hybrid festival. We knew not everybody could be traveling, so we were prepared for that. We, in the Netherlands, the Film Fund helped all the film festivals to build one big platform, so we used that platform. And then 2-3 weeks ago, the situation in the Netherlands is not that good. And we still have a curfew at 9 o'clock. It's now till 10 o'clock, but then we knew, and that will be till the end of April, that a festival offline was not realistic anymore. So like 2-3 weeks ago, we said, okay, we can only go online. So we're now preparing Q&As pre-recorded. We do Meet the Makers live, so we film audiences can meet the filmmakers. We have masterclasses. We have a big industry program, all focus on impact, but it all will be online. We will be hosting a masterclass with the people from the filmmakers from Myanmar, which I find very highly impressive, and Belarus, and also with the filmmakers living in Camp Moria at Lesbos as well. So we do all kind of different things.
And before I forget, what are the dates for this year's edition of the Movies That Matter Festival?
Yeah, it's from the 16th of April and then 10 days to the 24th of April. And especially all the industry program is accessible for people from all over the world. Unfortunately, the films are obviously geo-blocked. Only the shorts everybody can watch.
Right. So they will only be accessible to people in the Netherlands.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So, but let's just say that there are people listening to this who are in the Netherlands, who may be even students or people from all over the world that would like to access the films. How do they get to do that?
Just go to our website, www.moviesthatmatter.nl, and you click on wherever you like to go and you register, and you can see whatever industry is there. And for the films, you have to pay, and for the industry, that's for free. So I encourage them all to go to the website and just navigate your way through and find the things you'd like to attend.
We'll be back to talk more about this year's edition of the Movies That Matter Festival in a moment.
Fred Film Radio.
We're back with Markia de Koning, and we have been talking about the Movies That Matter Festival, which usually takes place in The Hague in the Netherlands, but will be taking place online this year from the 16th to the 25th of April in response to the pandemic. I wanted to ask you, this has obviously been a difficult year, and aside from the coronavirus pandemic, it's also been a time of social unrest and protests all over the world. Do you feel the program of Movies That Matters this year reflects the current global situation?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. We have films, obviously, on Black Lives Matter. And as I mentioned, we're doing a big, let's say, webinar panel, whatever you like to say, on what's going on in Myanmar and also in a place like Belarus. We're going to talk to filmmakers over there by the Zoom, of course. What's going on in Camp Moria? I think we are hosting a big masterclass on that and meeting the filmmakers living in Camp Moria at the time. And I think due to the whole COVID situation, filmmakers under censorship, filmmakers under pressure, are having obviously very hard time. So where we can, as a human rights film festival, we will try to address their situation, but always with the link of film. So we will show short films from Myanmar, from Belarus, some clips. And for sure, we will show films from film students in Camp Moria, for instance. Of course, that's what we do. And we have three big themes calling. We call it Take on Love, Take on Power, and Take on Future. And there we will address, sure, Black Lives Matters. We will address what's going on with the environment. We will address what's going on in politics and in what's happening in the world of power at the moment. Of course, for sure. For sure.
And again, let's just remind the listeners that there, aside from the film program itself, there will be talks, Q&As, and other events that will be taking place this year. Is it audience interaction something that you're also looking at doing on this year's online edition?
For sure we do. Of course, what we do is if you have, for instance, a masterclass, we also will have a masterclass which might be super nice for people to follow. It's by the Oscar-nominated team, Julie Goldman and Maite Alberto, on The Mole Agent, the documentary. They will, for instance, host a masterclass. And at the end, we always make sure that people, through the Q&A, everybody's familiar with that now, can ask questions to filmmakers, for sure. We have that every day in Meet the Maker, and you can chat with the filmmakers directly. Yes.
And so this festival is called Movies That Matter Festival. So I can't help but ask this question. Obviously, there has been so much happening also with the cinematic form that I just feel like asking you, do movies still matter?
Well, you know, I it's a very good question. And I think in a way more than ever, because if it's a long movie or a short movie, when I see I dive into your life through the screen and I did not know about that life, and it makes me think, and I have, and then we can talk about it and we can discuss it. That, therefore, that I think, to put it a bit bold, film is like a weapon for conversation and maybe opening people's eyes and maybe change the world through that a little bit. Knowing how harsh the world is at the moment. But if I speak to the filmmakers from activists, I spoke to the filmmakers just of Fly So Far, a film where the filmmakers take it up for the women who lose their child, and by doing that, which is nearly unborn child, saying it's abortion and put them in jail. And if you talk to them, and we see that, I'm so happy we can show this film at your festival because it might help us politically. Then a film really matters, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's cynical, yeah, but I'm not cynical. I honestly believe every stone you throw in the water, you never know where it reaches the corners of the world, right?
I agree with you 100%. I definitely think that cinema matters. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't be hosting this show.
I think you would not. I think it would be very, very fascinating. No, and we are part of a huge human rights film network, over 40 films, film festivals around the world, of which quite a few we support financially. And if you see what they try to do in the desert somewhere and in all corners of the world where we have really, really close contact with, it's really impressive what film can do.
Well, we're on the topic of film. Is there anything, are you guys also interested or involved in audience development and maybe involved with younger audiences too?
Yes, that's what we're really trying to. We host a whole, but this is this year for the Dutch, all the film academies, art schools, whatever, all the young filmmakers in the Netherlands, to a whole afternoon we host for documentary and fiction to talk about film content and impact. Yes, yes, we try to do that a lot. And we have a huge educational department. That's not so much a festival. We have an educational department and we have an international support department. So we're reaching over, the Netherlands is not so big, so we're reaching over nearly 200,000 pupils per year with Films That Matters.
Yeah, so obviously Movies That Matter definitely goes beyond the actual festival itself. There's year-round activities taking place.
Absolutely,
too.
Absolutely. On youth especially, we tour around the whole year with our festival through the whole of the Netherlands. And we have, which I'm extremely proud of, a huge international support film festival department, and that's incredible, where people under really harsh circumstances try to pull off a film festival, and in a way we try to help them to do so. And like for this year, we have a whole workshop for them as well at our festival. So there's, apart from the what's running in terms of films, there's a whole workshop running for festival organizers from all over. So that's really cool as well, I think personally.
Awesome. It's fantastic. So let me remind our listeners that Movies That Matter Festival takes place from the 16th to the 25th of April 2021. Thank you very much for joining us and talking with us about it. I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much for talking to me. Thank you so much.
Fred Film Radio. Fred Film Radio.
The latest edition of the Berlinale, Chiara Nicoletti had a chat with director Alexei Paluyan about his documentary Courage, narrating one aspect of the struggle for democracy in his native Belarus. Here's a clip of that interview.
So, Alexei, I would like to start with the title of the film, because I felt it was perfect, as the film shows courage and at the same time gives strength and courage. So is that the reason behind the film and its title?
Yes, it's for sure. It was my very important goal to find such title that could give the key to the main statement of the film. And I think that courage is really suitable for this film, because if you look at the situation in Belarus, you will see that people have this hope, and sometimes they didn't have this hope. And for me, courage is also the situation. If you don't have a hope, you do what you want to do through this hopeless. And for me, it is a courage.
When did you decide that you wanted to do a film about the people fighting for democracy in Belarus? And why did you think that you could do it by focusing on your friends, Marina, Pavel, and Denis, that they belong, the actors, and they belong to the Belarus Free Theater?
The first idea came to me as I was a student in Belarus. It was about 10 years ago. But later, I started film school in Germany, and I think it was 2018 that I decided Alexei, enough, you, it's the time to speak more loud about this topic. And I decided to work with this through protagonists, because I admired a lot of these people, not only for professional principle of them, but also for personal. You know, I admired Marina, Denis, and Pyle because they decided to do an art in such authoritarian countries. It's not so easy way, but they do it, you know, and stayed with this principle, were honest of this decision. And I appreciate it, because sometimes I think about it, it's maybe a naive and romantic idea to be an independent artist in such authoritarian countries. What is to be? Maybe it's not possible. Maybe it is such kind of utopia, yeah, for young artists. But if you look at the film, you will understand that's really honest and it's really serious for this person. They do it, this professional, it's not job, it's professional of them since 15 years. And I decided to speak about the role of artist in such countries, because I say it a lot of time in Germany. I believe and I think that power of artists play a big role in such countries in Western Europe. And unfortunately, in West Europe, this power of voice of artists in West Europe is not so strong as previous, you know. For example, at the time of Antonioni or at the time of Pasolini, you know. Now it's economic, have much more power as artists. I don't like this situation, but maybe it's time to speak about it right now in Europe and to say, people, look what's happened. And yeah, and I believe that art could fight with such political crisis.
To listen to the full interview, check out fred.fm/UK.
Fred.
Cinephile, we have reached the end of yet another episode of the Big Fred Tuesday, but as usual, the best way to end it is with a brand new offering of our weekly Popcorn Classics segment. This is the part of the show where I highlight one of the films that I feel has maybe fallen under the radar, or that I feel will help you, dear listener, in your cinephile explorations. It's all in the name of fun, of course. But this week's Popcorn Classic is another title from the fabled period known as the Czech New Wave. We've talked about it in the past. This was a period of film in Czechoslovakia where the stranglehold of socialist authorities and censorship was loosened up in and around the period of liberalization known as the Prague Spring. It was short-lived, lasted only a couple of years, but managed to produce an incredible number of noteworthy films that are still acclaimed to this day. One of these is definitely The Joke from 1969, which was based on a novel by Milan Kundera and directed by Jaromil Jiříš. It's essentially a revenge film where a man tries to get revenge on the man who kicked him out of the Communist Party in his college years for making a joke many years after the fact by sleeping with his wife. Anyone watching this will be able to notice that absurdist surrealism that is part of the characteristic Czech New Wave style, that bitter sense of irony, and fans of Milan Kundera will see this same style reflect the author's own idiosyncratic writing style as well. Kundera was famously critical of the 1988 version of his masterwork, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, and I'm not sure what he thought about this filmic take on the joke, but if anyone knows, get in touch with me, I'd love to find out. To me, The Joke is one of the best cinematic adaptations of a Milan Kundera book I have ever seen. It's full of irreverence and attacks on totalitarianism that reflected the spirit of Prague Spring I mentioned earlier, and would no doubt have been impossible to make outside of this short window of time. It's no wonder that after Prague Spring, it ended up being banned for the next 20 years. But there you have it, folks. Another great Czech New Wave film for you to check out. Pardon the pun. The Joke from 1969, our popcorn classic of the week. And that's also the end of our show. Don't forget to tune in for next week's show. And let me remind you that there's plenty more content for you to sink your ears into across all of the various channels on Fred.fm. Till the next time, folks, stay healthy, stay safe, stay strong, stay cinephile, and stay tuned to Fred Film Radio, the festival insider.
Fred.
This is Natasha Sinjanovic for Fred Film Radio.
Fred Film Radio, z vami sam Bor Pruteršek.
Fred Film Radio, sono Angela Prudenzi.
Essa Fred Film Radio, ja chiamo Marianne Morissau, do Festival di Berlino.
Angela Cerbi per Fred Film Radio, on è au Festival de Venise.
Fred, the festival experience in 23 languages.
Fred Film Radio.
24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.